On today's College Football Inquirer, 5 years to play five, the thing coaches have wanted for decades. Well, now the NCAA is on board, but can it work? Because it's going to inspire a couple more lawsuits. Plus, Ross Dellinger explains what might actually happen from the executive order, what is possible and what is less than possible. Also, Miami lands a commitment from a big-time quarterback recruit. That's interesting because their starting quarterbacks tend to come from the transfer portal. We'll break it all down on today's College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer with Ross Dellinger and Stephen Godfrey. I am Andy Staples. Ross is back, and he's not out of eligibility yet, but he had a very interesting story on Wednesday about the NCAA.
Well, according to the new proposal, I would be out of eligibility.
You're done,
right?
You're too old.
Yeah, I'm done.
Geezer.
That's right.
Yeah, five to play five. The pipe dream of college football coaches circa 2002, and it's very simple to explain. Instead of you have 4 years or 5 years to play 4 years, where you'd have a redshirt year potentially, you get 5 years. You can play all 5 years. You cannot play all 5 years, but when the 5 years are over, you're done. That's basically it, right, Russ?
Yeah. It's a pretty simple deal, and I think it was intentional in that to simplify specifically the waiver redshirt stuff. So let break down before we get to Mr. Godfrey's comments, because I know he has some thoughts on this. But let me break down some parts of this, right? Number one, it eliminates redshirts, even medical redshirts, in the waiver system, which has been the single biggest thing that the NCAA has been sued over. Lately, at least in the last year, has been waiver request denied based on medical redshirt stuff and all that. So it eliminates
the Trinidad Shambliss
those
situation.
Two things.
So
yeah, right.
That's, that people want to understand why this is happening. So essentially, NIL happens. Players start getting paid. Naturally, players are incentivized to try to play as long as they can because they can continue making good money, especially if they're not going pro or maybe not envisioned as being potentially great pros. And so Trinidad Shambliss, who probably will play in the NFL, but definitely was going to make money to start at Ole Miss this year, he didn't challenge the rule of the eligibility rule. He didn't say this rule that says I can only play four seasons is, you know, a violation of the Sherman Act or whatever. He didn't say that. He said, you applied the medical hardship waiver rule unevenly, and you've done that for years, and I'm going to prove that in court. And that is how he won an injunction. And so in this case, they're taking away the waiver process that would be the thing most athletes would attack in court.
Right. So that's when you look at intentions of this, that's number one. The second intention with the age, which is, you know, from your 19th birthday or whenever you graduate high school, whatever's earliest, but the fact that they put in an age 19, I think the intention behind that probably is to prevent older players, right, in their mid to late 20s from playing in college. That would
that
certainly
feels more aimed at basketball than football.
Basketball, soccer, yep. And hockey, certainly, where you have players that that leave high school early, right, and then play in the semi-pro or professional overseas or in Canada, and then don't start their college careers to their 20 or 21 or so on. So that's the second intent. I would say that those are probably the two biggest intents for the rule. So eliminate any legal challenges over the inconsistent sort of waiver and redshirt system, and prevent much older players from playing in college. And I know Mr. Godfrey has thoughts, but I would say one last thing.
Yeah.
Usually when a report on an NCAA rule or new rule or policy or whatever, it doesn't go well in the public sphere, right? The reaction is usually fairly negative. I'm going to guess the reaction here has been 85 to 90% positive from
right.
Just the fan, not just obviously administrators and all that people in college, but certainly the fan base. And I even got a text, and he actually made it public So I think I can tell it now, say it now, from maybe the most NCAA hating lawyer there is, a one Tom Mars thinks this is a sensible and good rule that the NCAA has made. So shocking revelation there. Well, but
because, like, knowing Tom a little bit, him being part of the impetus for the rule being made, he probably enjoys quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. That's just an appeal to his vanity, for sure.
He did figure out how best to attack it, and therefore them trying to Tom Mars proof it is quite a compliment.
Well, and I'm glad, Andy, you mentioned the Trinidad case, because that a week after that is when I at least first learned that this was in the pipeline, so to speak. Yeah. So it's been a while. It's been 6 weeks of this behind the scenes before it gets to the D1
and before,
cabinet.
Before we cede the floor to Godfrey,
I don't have that much to
the effects of this thing, which might go into effect as early as this academic year, doesn't affect players already in the pipeline.
Yeah,
the
it won't system. Be retroactive. No, right. No, so, hardly no rule is. Yeah,
retroactive. Yeah. So Trinidad Chambliss will play this year. He's got the injunction. He's going to play. It would be for incoming freshmen.
In to be clear, even if it was retroactive, right? NCAA rules, even if they are in support of an executive, or even if they are supported by an executive order from the president, they don't supersede court rulings. Neither does an executive order.
Right. As much as the NCAA would love to be more powerful than the actual court of law in the United States, that still hasn't happened yet.
Right.
My apologies to Indianapolis. Yeah,
that's right.
So,
Godfrey, tell us how you feel.
Yeah, because the group chat was popping yesterday.
The group chat was popping. Yeah, I've had some time to sit with it, and some of this is still as laughable as when I first received it. Some of it looks like it's more of just a political half measure, I think, to appease people. Ross, I would definitely challenge the idea that it has been received that positively. I think because it is so simplistic, it is being received positively because people don't understand all of the different case studies that'll, go into challenging this eventually. I don't think people have also gamed out the situation that actual injuries that occur are going to cost people their livelihood. So that's in talking to people yesterday is the first sort of kind of like aghast response I got from what you might call the labor class of the NCAA, if there is such a thing. Basically meaning that if you are suffering an injury now, multiple, let's just say two season ending injuries, or one, you tear an ACL in spring practice, or you have something happen in week two of a season and you lose a year, you have essentially cost yourself the ability to create a living for yourself. Because what the NCAA is doing here is fortifying their position that you should not be able to make a living playing their games. This is a football podcast. I'm not even going to get into how this jacks up NCAA hockey. The fastest way to explain this, I did an entire show, I'll link it on social, on my other show, Phantom Island, about the idea of amateurism in hockey. It is sort of shades of gray because of the way that hockey players are developed from a pre-high school age through when they actually become what we in America might consider to be professionals, Canadian juniors, and the development leagues that start basically in like the middle school age. The designation of pro versus amateur has been sort of reinterpreted so that you're seeing an uptick of players going to the NCAA, which has provided a benefit to everyone involved in the NCAA hockey world. Okay. You're getting an opportunity at education. You're getting an opportunity at NIL. You're getting an opportunity to play on national television. It has been better for the sport, full stop. It changed the dynamic of juniors in Canada, but there's some other issues going on in Canadian hockey that have to do with just, it's a really expensive sport and their development pipelines are having issues. I don't really know, and I've asked a lot of people to look into this, how this is going to affect hockey. I got nothing.
Well,
I don't know yet.
Well, most people care about football and basketball, and how it affects football is different than how it affects basketball. Football, the 19-year-old age limit doesn't mean anything because most football players, except for maybe some Australian punters, most football players go to high school in America. They want to go straight to college and play football. They want to get to the NFL as quickly as possible. So it wouldn't really change much for them. Basketball is where that one definitely feels aimed, because Godfrey, you mentioned the hockey system in Canada. The developmental system in Europe in basketball is completely different than America. You're essentially part of a club team that is part of a pro organization. You work your way up through that. And so essentially you got guys that have been playing pro that realize, okay, I'm never going to make it to the NBA, but I can make some money playing in college as a 22, 23-year-old, 24-year-old. And so I'm going to do that. And they've never enrolled in college, so their eligibility clock hasn't started yet. That is probably where that's aimed. I would challenge that immediately if I were a plaintiff's attorney. And if I were the NCAA, I would get rid of that part. I would change it back to when you enroll in college, and I would make the definition of college very broad so that it includes junior college, so that it includes anything else. But I would make the definition of college quite broad in that aspect.
I think the age and the simplicity of the proposal, unfortunately, are what make it seem so stupid. Because there are so many intricacies involved here in the NCAA. You're talking about so many different sports that this is bound to fail.
The intricacies are the problem and have always been the problem. If you make it simpler, you leave less to attack, and you also, like,
that's the thought.
It's the good of the many over the good of the few, which is kind of how decisions about laws get made a lot of the time in the world.
Except now we have so much precedent in civil suits that we know this is going to get challenged. We know it's going to get broken apart. What frustrates me about this kind of stuff is that we are delaying an inevitable reshaping of the fundamental fabric of how we do college sports. And
they need to do a CBA. Like, they do. It would be easier because
it goes beyond this, because what I see in this is shades of the Bediako case at Alabama in basketball. And what I see is a complete misunderstanding of some other scholarship sports that the NCAA claims that they want to make as big and as profitable and as healthy for the student athlete as possible. And yet none of that is represented here. What this is jamming home a talking point to basically continue to feed this hysteria. I love the graph in here, Ross, that these bastard million-dollar quarterbacks, these 25-year-old at just complete brigands, complete mercenaries, are stealing scholarships from young men across the country. Mm. Except there's a problem here, which is that we've never had more scholarship FBS and FCS programs. We're onboarding more as we speak, right? Ross, didn't you have a tweet last week about the University of West Florida in beautiful Pensacola, which is better than 30A, right? There are there are schools across the country.
Who's 30A's catching a stray, man?
30A, ask Neil Brown. 30A always catches a stray. So look, we have more scholarships opening. We have more programs playing football. I'm confused what this crisis is, gentlemen. Oh, by the way, the television ratings have never been stronger.
I will explain why people wanted it for 20 years. And now the people who want it now are different people, but the people who wanted it for 20 years were the coaches, because they were sick of, oh, is my guy going to get a waiver? Can he play? I don't know. How do I handle my roster? Or the more fun one, since the 4-game redshirt rule passed in football, who's going to come down with a case of fifth-game-itis?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what you've had. You've had guys who are like, oh, I'm shutting it down so I can get paid next year.
I think there's just a lot of situations people have not taken. We haven't taken a lot of these things into account. Do you remember the North Texas quarterback, Austin? I think his last name is pronounced Ani. He was 26, 27. He had finished a minor league baseball career. And then I think at one point he may have been a UFA signing in the NFL.
Get rid of the age limit. Just do it at the start of college. Now, there are waivers, very limited ones.
The BYU thing.
Reported.
Yeah. People are going to ask about the LDS.
Right.
Religious mission. It's not just LDS. You could go on mission. You can do mission work for another religion as well. Mission work, military service, maternity leave.
The three M's,
Ross, as you put it.
You can do mission work for any religion, but there's only one in college football that provides you 28-year-old married linebackers and offensive linemen with four kids.
Yeah.
And that's BYU at the LDS church.
I'm guessing some different religions might sprout up. Who knows? Maybe Baylor wants to do this with
that. Oh, you hacked it, Andy?
Is this possible?
You hacked it, Andy. They were on.
There you go. There's a workaround. We're going to create some new religious missions.
I think we all know the schools love to work around the rules,
don't we? Latin America. all over knocking on doors because they would like to have some older linemen at Baylor.
This quote in here, Ross, this quote in here, Ross, I love so much. The phone calls I get from coaches and ADs are pretty consistent. I don't like it when a judge ends up in front of what state they're in, determines blah, 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 blah. So that's not fair. Talking about Charlie Baker, the president of the NCAA. I love that quote because I doubt that the ADs and coaches who are trying to jam home eligibility for some player who's crucial to a playoff run actually say that. Okay. What this is.
Oh, no, not those. Yeah, that's right. I don't think he got a call from Greg Byrne.
No.
Saying that. Probably all the other ADs in the SEC.
Except for Keith Carter, who was busy trying to get Trinidad eligible.
Nah, that's true. I'm glad that Godfrey brought up two things because I think two groups of athletes are sort of disadvantaged by this, right? It's pretty obvious. The ones that have experienced multiple injuries in a career, which has certainly happened before, right? We've heard of the kid who's torn, you know, two or three times his ACL.
Michael Penix played in a national title game. Michael Penix. This isn't an obscure. Right. This isn't an obscure condition. We can start
rattling
these off.
Michael Penix would have been able to play in that national title game under this, right?
I don't remember his exact situation. I don't know how old he was.
Well,
yeah.
The
COVID year.
When I did this, I was going to provide more examples, but COVID complicates this because of the we're still slowing that off.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I think the issue would. So he was a true freshman in 2018. His final year was 2023. So no, he would not have been able to without the COVID year.
And the other group of athletes, obviously, is the international players that, you know, seem to mostly arrive well after their 18th or 19th birthday, right? Because they play in the Canadian League or in the European League. And so those players would either have to do one of two things, come over here earlier, right? Or their college careers are limited instead of 5 years to two, three, whenever they decide to come over here. But it certainly impacts those athletes.
Keeping foreigners definitely feels like it came from the president, keeping the foreigners out.
Here's why I think that there has been a more positive response to this. And you know me, I'm usually on Godfrey's side in these things. And this is one where I think they might have a chance. I still think the surest way to ensure eligibility rules that make sense, that everyone agrees on, is to have a CBA where, like, for example, Maurice Claret challenged the NFL's CBA, which he had no part in creating, and it held up, like, the age limit for the draft. So it would hold up if you did it that way. But, and you've pointed this out multiple times, Ross, the NCAA in these eligibility cases in federal court, the antitrust eligibility cases, the NCAA has a better than 500 record. The NCAA in compensation cases in federal court is over.
Not
they can't
great,
win any
right.
of them.
Right.
They in might fact, actually the NDA... be able to fight to defend this is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean,
I think the consumer wants something that makes it look like the age of most college students, that's who's playing this thing.
Yeah, I actually have, I think probably some of our listeners would be interested in knowing the updated sort of numbers on this. 74 eligibility lawsuits filed against the NCAA in the last, 14, 15 months or so, really since Diego Pavia's. So 74, 34 of those have been an NCAA win. 12 of those have been an athlete win. So only 46 of the 74 have been actually ruled on right now when it comes to a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction. So it's about two-thirds of the cases right now the NCAA has won. They've spent over $16 million fighting these cases in the last year. I think there's a thought, especially in federal court, Andy, and potentially up to the Supreme Court, that they'll have a good shot at winning the eligibility portion of any any right. lawsuit.
If I were them, this is what I would fight, as opposed to any of the compensation rules or the transfer ones, none of which you've won anything on. Now, that said, this, and I wrote about this for On3, like, this will get more expensive for them. If they passed this in 2010, nobody would have cared. It would have been fine. Now, they are going to get sued by all of the NIL era athletes who only got 4 years to play.
Yep.
And they might just have to write them a check.
Yep.
That's 16.
And that is a big, it's the big fear, is this another civil action lawsuit.
Whose fear? The NCAA's
fear. NCAA's fear.
Yeah. Yes, no one else cares. Sure. Yeah. No, everyone else is just trying to make it
look. Well, in the conferences and the schools, there is no actual,
but there's no anxiety or fear here. It's fear of a regulatory body that is increasingly obsolete.
It's basically them making a decision that settling with that, you know, settling that still yet filed lawsuit.
Yeah.
Is less painful than just dying by 1,000 paper.
Well, remember the House case too was a, right, it was a civil action for back NIL pay.
Yes, exactly.
And so this would be potentially a civil action for back eligibility and loss of potential NIL or compensation for that 1 year.
I still want
less money than the House, but still probably significant.
I still need to find these poor, unfortunate souls who have been denied a chance at a college education because of some greedy 26-year-old quarterback. I got to find these people because I hear a lot about it from coaches and athletic directors, NCAA, and then those narratives get parroted in the media. I'm still trying to struggle to find
but
where all these
kids
who are
parroted here. I don't care about that.
It's all over these reports, but it's like, and I'm not saying Ross is doing it, but I'm saying the NCAA people that are quoted in Ross's story, that's what they're talking about. They're trying to create a crisis that doesn't exist. Is this idea that some guy's going to stay in college?
It's not.
No, of course there's no crisis. They're saying it's a crisis.
They don't want to have to fight 50 different cases at once in a bunch of different states. They would rather just have something that might hold up. And
that doesn't matter.
It might hold up.
It doesn't matter. We are now in a labor market. This is a compensation sport. Okay, you can now make money off of this. Their inability to put their arms around
It holds up. Like if the federal court system says these eligibility rules, we're cool with them, which they have said, then those would be the rules.
I would.
Well, but also like,
and you could keep suing and hope for a different result, but
God.
Eventually,
but
if you
also,
keep losing, the plaintiff's attorneys don't want to do it.
I'll believe that part when that part happens. That's the thing that I'm having trouble digesting right now, is that this doesn't
go. There will be lawsuits to challenge this initially. And here's the thing. If they lose the lawsuits, if the NCAA loses, it will just push them more toward the logical conclusion that we keep telling you is going to happen. They will eventually have a CBA. They'll get there eventually. But
yeah.
They're going to keep trying stuff until they have to.
I am curious.
The stuff about the high school, Godfrey, like, I don't know. I mean, obviously, like, it'll be really interesting. We only have 1 year of data, right? So it's probably hard to, like, but you certainly hear, and I think high school coaches have been quoted at this quite a bit, of saying, like, hey, our kid who would have gone to whatever, you know, Texas or Ohio State, is now having to go to, you know, Mississippi State. And the kid that used to go to Mississippi State is now having to go to Memphis. And the kid that used to go to, there's like this trickle of down
and
effect.
They play well and they go to the place they were going to go anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, and they make $6 million in Miami. System.
Yeah, it's created the farm. But I guess,
but
to me,
that's not because of eligibility.
Sort of comp-
that's, hang on, that's not
well,
because of eligibility. That's because of you want to win a national championship and you're paying top dollar for the most experienced talent to do it. Has nothing to do with what we're talking about today. This is
the
false premise they're operating from.
They can't actually do anything about because they lose every case on those.
This is why I'm saying I'm struggling to see why these are all not connected and why this thing's going to live when you can so easily pull
because
it into.
Because the one place that they can win with the consumer is the consumer doesn't really want 28-year-old quarterbacks either.
Oh, it's pretty clear. The fans have been clear about that.
Yeah.
Like, we'll see.
When people said, I'll stop watching if they pay them, that wasn't everybody. A lot of people were like, no, you should pay them. That was, and then the numbers have borne it out. People don't want to see a 35-year-old quarterback. They just
And 35 is, look, let's be honest. You know 35 is a hyperbolic example. What we're talking about here is that gray area.
You're physically not capable anymore.
Yeah.
And if you were physically capable at 35, you're probably still in the NFL. So
right. Well, I think the only thing that we've seen an actual public referendum on is an ex-professional going back to college in the same sport.
Yeah.
Betty Yocco was the only time we saw a true line in the sand in public.
This would not necessarily stop that, but it would probably limit that to very, very, very few cases.
Doesn't it make sense? And maybe I'm just like thinking about it too simple here, that if, let's just take the example of Trinidad, you know, if he were to have moved on, wouldn't have that opened a spot for a transfer or a high school player? Am I crazy?
I mean, roster
squads are now, right, the limits are now really small because the house case, right, shrunk everything and put a restriction on it. So, like, if a player doesn't move on, that's a spot that could have gone to transfer or a high school player? Like, am I just thinking about it? Isn't that like?
Oh yeah, no,
it's zero.
Right?
It's zero sum at this point. And,
The issue is the magnitude, and the issue is how it's being portrayed. Because what you're talking about is still percentage points of a sport that is expanding and increasing more scholarship availability every single freaking year. That's the part that I laugh at. That's the part where the coaches.
Yeah, that's true. It's probably a low percentage.
Oh no, listen, Godfrey, they lied about this every step of the way. Like, all they do is lie to protect their corners.
Absolutely.
That doesn't mean they don't have the occasional workable idea. And they might have hit what's interesting, again, this was a good idea 20 years ago.
Yes.
And the people who want it now were the ones who fought it the hardest.
Which is kind of where I'm actually at. It's not there are aspects of this that aren't bad. The problem is I don't know if the overall proposal I don't think is applicable. I think it doesn't take a lot of sports into account. And it's such slow moving evolution, if you want to call it that. I really don't think it's evolution. I think this is just another thing to get tied up in litigation. I'm curious, Ross, do you think it's
an extension of purgatory if they can extend it.
Which is what a lot of these people making a healthy living in the NCAA want to do. They just want to they want to prolong the circumstance so they can get by in their current status. But Ross, do you think this is, I'm curious if, let's say this locks in and I'm wrong. Is this the kind of proxy that the big two schools want so they can let the NCAA enforce the things that they don't want to deal with? Or does this inspire secession? I feel like this is probably, if you're going to keep the NCAA around to flog, this is what you keep it around to do and then complain about.
This is a great point. And we haven't touched on it. We haven't touched on it. Is that part of the, I think, I haven't really been told this, but I'm just putting pieces together that I think part of what pressured the NCAA to come up with this and find some kind of quote solution was public and private comments in potentially schemes from the SEC and Big Ten about doing its own governance, right? We've seen that publicly, some things said, and I've wrote about it in January. I don't think there's any doubt that that has to do with some of this. And then the other part, I think, is just the cases that the inconsistency of cases that happened, like Trinidad getting a year, the Ole Miss quarterback getting a year, and then 3 weeks later, the Tennessee quarterback not getting a year. I think that sort of just all of that. But Godfrey, I think you're right. This is a way to say, hey, the NCAA has some worth, right? We're gonna stay within this thing if they can sort of enforce this new policy. I think there's a lot of that going on.
It's
not
funny,
just
though,
with the eligibility,
does,
but with tampering
take away
as
work
well.
For
tampering
them.
Rules.
It does take away work for them because now there are no waivers to discuss.
I'm sure they'll reduce their staff accordingly.
Yeah.
They have done that, but a lot of that has been to pay for the house back pay.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of had to do that. They had to come up with the money somehow.
Mm.
This was one of the things that was addressed in the executive order. Ross, you wrote a column about other parts of that executive order. Godfrey and I went over it on Tuesday, what probably will and won't happen. You got much more granular. The parts that can happen, the parts that likely can't happen. Let's talk about that when we come back. We are back to College Football Inquirer, and Ross Dellinger has a column at On3 on Thursday about what actually can be implemented from the president's executive order regarding college sports. Godfrey and I went over a lot of it the other day, and basically on first read, there wasn't a whole lot that they could actually do. Though one thing Godfrey and I brought up was five to play five, and at the time we'd been talking about the thing we just mentioned, the possibility of a lawsuit from other players that they would have to pay off, and that doesn't seem to be bothering them. So what else might there be that they could just sort of fight their way through and actually try to implement?
There were nine, if you go through it, there were nine sort of directives that Trump delivered sort of to the NCAA, instructing them to create legislation over, you know, nine issues. And one obviously was the eligibility. We just discussed that at length. So what are the other eight? Obviously, you know, in there, it says professional athletes cannot return to college athletics. Certainly the NCAA's eligibility policy probably limits that, as we discussed in portion. And also the NCAA is kind of down the road in changing some pre-enrollment policies. So they may be able to sort of limit that, probably not completely eliminate it. Number two, and probably the biggest of these, right, is, and I'll read it from the EO, provide for the ability to transfer one time during the five-year period with immediate playing eligibility. So in reinstituting the one-time transfer policy, there's a big, big, big problem with this one. It's probably the most difficult one for the NCAA to change. Any change here, the NCAA risk violating a lawsuit and a settlement that it reached with the Department of Justice and a coalition of states to end the one-time transfer policy. So I don't know how that they would achieve.
Well, the Department of Justice is part of the executive branch. So.
Correct. Yes, which makes it even more interesting that the Department of Justice's ultimate boss has just told the NCAA to violate a settlement that the Department of Justice agreed to. Right.
It's almost like they don't know.
Was it his Department of Justice? I'm trying to remember the timing.
It was not.
Almost like he doesn't know what he's doing. It's crazy. This was where I tuned out, by the way. When I started reading, I was like, oh, yeah, okay, this is
when you started reading.
Yeah. This is fabricated. We're done. Yeah, none of this is going to happen.
So I don't. So a lot of the people that were so excited about the re-implementation of the one-time transfer should know that it is highly unlikely to happen. Yeah.
I would like to. Can I just pose a quick situation? So, Yuri,
sure.
all the head coaches that we talk about, Andy, all the up and comers, all the young guys, they go to a school, they sign about 45, 50 transfers at their first school, maybe like a high G5, right, Andy? And like they win 9 or 10 games and they're red hot. And then they get the big job. They get the big two job. You know what the next thing they do is with that roster that had about 45 or 50 transfers? They take the best 20, 18, maybe four starting line, maybe like a couple front seven guys, running back that could probably play at the next level, probably take their quarterback with them, like you know, North Texas to Oklahoma State, or all the guys from Tulane are going to be playing for Florida. What? Right.
USF,
all the guys Auburn, from Troy Tulane, that Florida. Played at Tulane. Yeah. Nobody is going to support this. Also, I would love to have a conversation. I tell you what, I'd be in favor of this if coaches signed it too. I'd be in favor of this if coaches.
That would be funny. Yes. Yeah. You only get one transfer every 4 years as a coach.
Yeah.
Now, coaches' wives would probably sign up for that.
Yeah. And if you get fired, you got to sit it out because we don't want this to we don't want to confuse the fans, because apparently what the NCAA is telling us is the fans are despondent because these kids keep showing up at different schools every year. We wouldn't want the coaches to do that either. So I think the fans
don't seem to mind that. Based on
that's because the fans who scream the loudest are the eldest generation of college football fans. Right. Young fans don't care. We're just reconditioning a generation. That's boomer stuff.
Yeah. Most fans still want to win. And even the older fans who yell, like I'll give you an example. Auburn is a great example of this. Much of USF's offensive skill talent will be playing at Auburn this year.
Yes, sir.
If that gives Auburn a functional offense and they have their first winning season since 2020, yes.
Fans will be excited.
Fans will be pumped. Pumped, regardless of whether they yelled about transfers or not. They will be pumped. But yeah, and what's interesting is NIL gets blamed for a lot of stuff. It is actually the transfer rule change that probably did the most.
Yeah.
To change
them happening together, right? I agree.
Because here's the thing. Even if there were no NIL, you take away the old transfer restrictions, people would be moving like crazy like this anyway, not for money, but for whatever reason.
Yeah, playing because time
coaches,
or whatever.
Mostly because coaches change their minds on players quite a bit. And that's so
what do you think
the biggest thing?
Andy, how much do you think Lane Kiffin would have signed for at LSU had he not been able to rework the roster in a matter of 3 weeks?
Oh,
how much do you think
he
actually would have been worth? Oh, okay. Okay, cool. So it would completely upend the coaching market as well. That's why it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen because that's, again, something the NCAA is over trying to defend in court. It is impossible to you cannot out of one side of your mouth say
keep going
these are not employees and then out of the other side of your mouth say we would like to hold them to these non-competes.
So what you're saying is this is a completely ridiculous suggestion. So why are we taking this EO seriously, Ross?
Well, some of these things can be done, right? Like obviously they're trying to do the eligibility thing. I think they can do a portion of the professional, like I mentioned, the professional athletes deal. But they can't do this one. Yeah, I don't know how they do this one other than, working with the Department of Justice in these states, right, to like overturn the settlement or agree to something, which, by the way, I mean, it's not outside the realm of possibility. I mean, the Department of Justice is now a Trump Department of Justice, and Trump wrote the EO. So is the NCAA and the Department of Justice having conversations? Perhaps. Will they end in some resolution to re-implement the one-time transfer? I cannot imagine that happening. But anyway.
Yeah, and probably not till there's another president in charge.
Right.
With a Department of Justice of their own. Because
that's right.
In 2 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, number three. Ensure that the transfer window doesn't incentivize interference with the athletic seasons. Well, this is an easy change. All they have to do is push back the football transfer portal this spring, which the Big Ten has wanted to do now for a couple of years.
And nobody else wants to do. So they got to get everybody else on board.
They would have to, but that's an easy one to do. The fourth one is medical care for athletes, like long-term medical care. The NCAA already does this. In fact, they increased all that a couple of years ago to support athletes. Should it be longer than what it currently is? Perhaps, maybe they could look into that. The fifth one is a tough one. Implementation of revenue sharing between higher education institutions and student athletes in a manner that preserves or expands scholarships for women's in Olympic sports.
It's already happening.
Already happening. Right. And that's the sort of facade in some of the narrative from the president himself and many others, is that women in Olympic sports would just completely disappear, at least at the power conference level right now. That is not happening. In fact, it's the opposite, right? Women's sports programs are getting hundreds more scholarships.
Men's programs are getting more scholarships too.
Yeah. Yes, for sure. For sure. So like that is already sort of happening. And it's funny. I think I said this on the pod, but during the round table, when Trump mentioned multiple times about how women's Olympic sports are in a terrible position and they're going to be eliminated, Jim Phillips, to his credit, stepped up from the ACC commissioner and said, actually, no, right? He didn't say it like that, although it would have been funny.
Well, Greg Sankey went on Feinbaum, the following Monday and said the same thing. Like,
yes.
I just want to clarify something here.
I think over 1,000 combined scholarships at the among the power conference four, over 1,000.
Well, good. They've already solved that one. So now they don't need to worry about it.
Hmm. There you go. Number six, a prohibition on the use of federal funds for NIL or coaches' compensation.
Good luck.
I don't know how
it's all one bucket. That's my favorite.
Yeah, it's all for your story. One bucket. Yes, it's all one bucket. So it doesn't really matter. I don't know how you would enforce that. I don't know if there's any way enforce that.
What crony stooge from the MLB wrote this for Trump? Do we know? Am I wrong? I'm not, am I? It's some one of those lackeys that worked on the ownership side of the MLB dispute, isn't it?
No. This was someone who, at least I read this, Ross, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong. It was someone who'd worked in the Southern District of New York in the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Oh, okay.
Or in a regulatory position.
Do they watch college sports?
Unclear. I mean,
half of this is either like, as you go down this, again, we were all supposed to take this so credulously, and I was hollering at other reporters last Friday. Half of this is either already happened or completely inapplicable. But keep going. I'm so glad the president weighed in.
Number seven. Banning collectives and pay for play. Again, I don't know what more you could do than what the College Sports Commission is sort of already responsible for doing this.
Yeah, they're over defending this in court because you can't ban pay for cook, you can't ban pay for medical care, you can't ban pay for teach, and why in the world would you care if somebody gets paid for play?
Yeah.
Very weird. It's very weird that this president of all people would be worried about a third party special interest somehow swaying the decision making process.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah, I mean, you can ban pay for cocaine, but you know that there's a negative consequence. Somebody might die. You can ban pay for murder because somebody dies, but you really can't ban pay for most things that don't actually harm anyone.
So the last thing is create an agent registry, which of course the NCAA does not have oversight over private agencies or agents in general. So I don't know how that could happen either. And I don't think
One way it could happen. There's one way it can happen. Some sort of governmental power, because I know some certain organizations that regulate agents in sports.
Mm-hmm, yep. Mm-hmm. There's a very easy way to do it, actually. I believe that there's a pretty popular tackle football league that already does this. By the way, this is the one that I would actually rally behind, because the stories, it's hard to separate what's ridiculous, what's histrionic or hyperbolic from what's actually happening. The people who are posing as or barely qualify as agents right now in the NIL and transfer world are an actual problem for student athletes, for football players. Yeah. I shouldn't use that phrase.
Here's a public service announcement. If you're a good college football or basketball player and your agent is charging you 20%, fire your agent today.
Also, they're not going to hit you up
on
Facebook.
Paying less than half.
Yeah, we do need to clean this up, because there's a lot of predatory agents out there, but that would require regulation, and that's not something that the people in charge want to do.
But here's the thing, Godfrey. Can't be mad at them wanting regulation for one thing and then say, but you do need to regulate this. Like, they know what the solution is. They know.
They do.
They just don't want to do it.
Okay, so I made a list of these nine directives. You know, I put them in four different categories. Yes, it can be done. Mm-hmm. It can be done. The second category, can be done to a degree. No, it can't be done. Or it's already been done. All right, so four of the nine, you really can't do. Right. Two, you can do. One with the eligibility already being done, and certainly with the transfer portal.
And the scholarships for women, which has already been done.
That goes into the other category, Andy, which is already done. There's two of these that have been already done. So four no, two yes, two already done, and maybe one you could kind of do a limited.
This reminds me of the movie Major League, where the GM is presented with the possible players for the roster that they need to tank so that they can move the team to Miami. This guy's dead. It's already done.
Already done. So yeah, if you combine the no, you can't do it, or it's already done, right? Six of the nine are in that category. So maybe the NCAA can do three of these things. Which is the eligibility, which is the transfer portal, and maybe to a degree, the pro athlete sort of limitation in college athletics. But so glad we got to the bottom of that. That's the EO. There it is. Boom.
World changing. Right. Wow. Very important stuff.
Well, let us talk about an actual changed world, or something that used to happen all the time that now seems strange when it happens, because a highly touted big time quarterback recruit just committed to Miami, which on its face, you know, 10 years ago would not have sounded strange. But the fact that Miami will have started three different transfer quarterbacks in three different years consecutively now looks kind of weird. Let's discuss when we return. We are back at the College Football Inquirer, and one of the things that we've talked about as all of this has changed in the sport is, what do you do in terms of recruiting quarterbacks? How do you handle that? Because traditionally, you would just sign the best high school guys you could get every single year, stack them up. Understand that some were going to leave because they didn't start. But now we've got programs that have basically established themselves as, we are going to start a veteran transfer. That is how we operate. And that's definitely been Miami the last few years. You know, it's been a while since Miami started a guy who signed with Miami in high school. I believe Tyler Van Dyke was the last one to do that on a regular basis. Emory Williams, of course, did start, broke his arm, I believe, against Florida State. And then the cavalcade of transfers began with Cam Ward, Carson Beck last year taking the national title game, now Darian Mensa coming from Duke. So it was very interesting the other day when Israel Abrams, who is a highly rated quarterback recruit out of the Chicago area, he's number 45 nationally among all players in the Rivals industry ranking. He's the number 3 quarterback in the country in the Rivals industry ranking. He committed to Miami. And that was surprising to me because I was wondering, did Miami suddenly have a philosophy change? Or does this mean that the market for high school quarterbacks has changed? Like, is there not a school throwing more money at him to come play more quickly? It's very interesting to see how this market's changing when this would have been completely normal 10 years ago. And now we're all like, what's going on here? What's up?
I think it's, if I had to pick, it's the latter, not the former, Andy. I think maybe the market is starting to correct a little bit on what we're paying an incoming freshman at quarterback, no matter how highly touted. Now, if you have a famous last name like Arch, that's different because there are other concerns involved in like ad revenue and, you know, you sort of come in as a pre-installed celebrity. But the normal 5-star kid who comes out of high school in Elite 11, maybe the market is tabled a little bit. We're seeing a plateau. Because the question I would throw back to y'all is, it's not cheap to do this. Mm-mm. Miami's philosophy has been to go out and cruise the market for an existing quarterback on basically a 1-year deal, right? While they are developing a young quarterback, they will still have to work in that market as well. So I don't see a way around having to spend more money at the quarterback position this way. But it also seems like what they want to do is get off the carousel. This is my biggest takeaway, is that ultimately, even the most deep-pocketed and NIL-aggressive, portal-aggressive programs, and it's obviously borne fruit for Miami, they were in the national championship game, even they don't want to live on the quarterback carousel because somebody's eventually going to bust in a bad way.
Yeah, they had the chance, I think we talked about this back in December, Miami had the chance to get off the quarterback carousel this year. Right.
And by they making Emory Williams the starter for next year. Yeah.
Right. I mean, and so they chose not to do that. Not only did they chose not to do that, they chose to make, the barrel was sort of, the bucket was sort of empty of quarterbacks, and they created a transfer in a way, right? By offering probably a lot of money to somebody who then was in the middle of a lawsuit with this.
Yeah, had already said school, he was coming back to the Darian team Mensa, he was on.
Right.
Yeah.
So they had a chance to do this, which it was surprising that they didn't get off the carousel then. But perhaps this is maybe the time they decided to do it. But my question is, like, if you're a high school quarterback, like the kid who committed to Miami, Do you want to go to Miami out of fear that they may get back on the carousel in a year or two when it's your turn?
That's present, I think, at a lot of programs. Real fast, two 12-team playoff years, eight teams in the Final Four. Off the top of my head, the only teams in the Final Four of the last two seasons with homegrown quarterback talent. Penn State, Drew Aller.
Texas,
Arch Manning. That's it, right? Ohio State, Notre Dame.
No, Texas not Arch Manning. Arch Manning was not
Quinn.
Starting quarterback.
Quinn Ewers
was.
That's right.
Initially went to Ohio State for NIL reasons, but...
So Ohio State and Notre Dame that year. So that's Will Howard and that's Riley.
Now Notre Dame notably has gotten off the carousel.
But
Notre Dame did Sam Hartman, Riley Leonard.
Yes.
Very happy with CJ Carr.
Yeah, but this is where I'm headed, Andy. Last year, all Final Four teams had transfer quarterbacks. Now,
yes.
Trinidad is a really unique situation because he wasn't poached. This was a D2 kid he was the backup. He didn't even start the season.
Right.
But then you go through the Final Four and it's like, all right, Carson Beck, high profile signee, right? Fernando Mendoza, part of the Indiana transfer portal NIL system.
Georgia and Miami wanted Fernando Mendoza.
Right. He was a get. So I guess what I'm getting at is that you don't have somebody needs to win a national championship or at least go to a national championship with a homegrown quarterback. And then otherwise,
I think CJ Carr is your best hope, right? CJ Carr and Arch Manning are your two best hopes.
Well, last year, I think my pick for the national championship was Drew Aller versus Arch Manning. Didn't happen. Just a bit off. Just a skosh.
Yeah.
You really want it. Godfrey wants the homegrown quarterback.
That's right. I don't like the NIL. I don't like the portal. It's ruining the game.
Yeah. And well, it's two plucky upstart programs, Texas and Notre Dame.
But
who else is out there? Who else is going to be in the preseason top, let's say, 15?
This is where I'm headed, guys.
Quarterback.
Yeah, it's not
it's very
about
few.
It's not the risk assessment anymore. I think it's that now we have created the culture of what championship have you won for me lately? Meaning, like, literally in the last 12 calendar months. It's kind of hard to fathom anybody taking that much patience around developing a quarterback over the course of three years without renting
and
someone.
And that's how
on
Jared Curtis, who is the number one quarterback in the 26 class, flips from Georgia to Vanderbilt because Georgia can't pay him like a starter because they already have a starter in Gunnar Stockton, homegrown, by the way. So he would be your other potential homegrown national title contender.
Most Georgia man ever.
But from Tiger, Georgia. But Jared Curtis goes to Vanderbilt probably for more money. We should assume that would make common sense. Yeah. And because there's a starting job open.
Yep. Don't want to be myopic about my dear neighbor Commodores, but it sure would make sense to me if I...
Are we calling Julian Sain homegrown? We should probably, right?
I was just looking at... He was at Alabama, he didn't play. At all, so
you could.
I don't know. I mean, he's still
again
transfer.
Though. I know
Marcel Reed. He qualifies.
Yeah, I like your faith in A&M.
They made the playoff last year. They lost by three to a team to play for the national title.
I'm not against it. I just said I like your faith. This is why it's hard. It's a stupidly small data set for us to do this, but
yeah.
That's why I expanded it. Well, I didn't take two national champions. I didn't even take four games.
What if Kyle Whittingham comes in and Bryce Underwood's awesome and they do it? And then all of a sudden, no, just pay top dollar for the best quarterback in high school.
Yeah. I mean, that's quarterback true. Michigan driven. Was probably on that list. Maybe BYU. Maybe.
Along that line
of
thinking,
Andy, is he homegrown? Bear Bachmeyer was a true freshman at BYU last year, but he did spring practice at Stanford.
Let me go
back to Underwood for a second. I think we're probably, and this is where I would want to defer to some of your recruiting analyst colleagues. Not all blue chip quarterbacks are created the same, right? Like Bryce
Underwood
was sort of
considered a can't miss
plug and play.
Can't misses. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's what I was getting at. So I think he might be an outlier that if Michigan were to just catch fire and rip through the playoff and go to the Final Four, I don't know if that's the same comp as any of the other kids that we're talking about. What we're getting at is it is both prohibitive for a national title run based off of a small amount of data and time consuming and expensive to develop a five-star quarterback from the high school, from signing him out of high school to taking him to an eventual national championship. We haven't seen it yet. And that's incredibly weird Alabama? To say.
Guess Alabama could. Depends on who wins that battle, right?
Yeah, if Keelan Russell wins it, yes. Because right, Keelan Russell is right. That what we're talking about, that five-star quarterback. Right. You had him sit for a year. But mm-hmm. Austin Mack is a guy who came with Kalen DeBoer from Washington.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really, when you did Kevin Jennings begin his career?
He did.
At SMU?
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah, he
okay.
did.
So, okay, top 20, preseason top 20. Here's the programs with a homegrown quarterback of the preseason top 20, way too early, top 20. Notre Dame, Georgia, Texas, Texas A&M, BYU, Michigan, Alabama, SMU. So we have basically half of them.
Surprised that it's actually is not in the top 20 you're looking at. Yeah, Damon Williams is another example who could be very good this year. Now that somebody tried to get him away from
there's about 21 in this. Yeah,
Damon Williams, yeah, notoriously loyal to Washington.
Yeah,
just yes. born with Huskies on his heart.
Nine of the top 20 have a homegrown quarterback. We'll see if one of those can pull it off.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by this because I wonder if Miami is going back. But I think what you guys said about getting off the carousel, because Godfrey's right. At some point, one of these schools that has had success doing this will hire a transfer quarterback who either by pure bad luck it's hurt or
mm-hmm.
just isn't that good in that environment. But you've seen it in other places where... Like Wisconsin's a great example of this. Speaking of Miami and Tyler Van Dyke, they get him. He gets hurt in the Alabama game in 2024. That's game three. He's out for the rest of the season. And then last year, they bring in Billy Edwards Jr., who gets hurt in game one. So it is like Colton Joseph taking the risk, the Old Dominion quarterback from last year, taking the risk on the potentially cursed position.
I think it's the dream is still alive for coaching staffs and personnel staffs and GMs.
Great
which
Wilson
is the
Phillips song.
The dream is still alive. I was thinking of the dream of the 90s from Portlandia.
They played that Wilson Phillips song after the Bulls won their first championship.
It was really
beautiful and glorious. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to sneak a Wilson Phillips song title into next week's show. I'm not even going to acknowledge it though.
Hold on.
Okay, not that easy. You didn't think I'd get that. All right. The dream is still alive. We're not going to harmonize. That you find and develop one of these quarterbacks and that they turn around and provide you two championship caliber years in succession wearing the same helmet and school colors.
You're talking about the window. Yes.
The window. Yeah. Wilson Phillips.
That's not what I thought we were doing today. In case you're wondering. In case you're scared. Godfrey's like, release me from all this.
No, this is good. I'm going to come
back
with it.
That's all the Wilson Phillips songs. I know. Hold on. I know. Release me and the dream is still alive. That's it.
I'm going to do the Bengals next week.
Yeah. Susanna Hoffs.
I'm taking Andy back to a place right now.
Young
that
Andy.
I did not intend to.
He's just thinking about that Eternal Flame video. Sorry. All right. Gentlemen, this has been a pleasure. I would put a pin in the quarterback recruiting discussion. This is something we can revisit during the season because I think we will have I would like a little more data. But
yeah, then 2 years.
This will continue to be interesting. So
yeah.
But we'll be back with the Bengals on Tuesday.